Memory is not that important. Memory is a consequence of what has happened before, that you can retrace your way back to that. But what happens before, it's so much more.
Welcome to Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change. I'm Ludvig Sundström.
And I'm Mikael Syding.
Today we're joined by Mattias Ribbing. Mattias is an author, educator, and three-time Swedish champion of memory sport. He's also become the Grandmaster of Memory internationally. This is not so easy to do. It requires a lot of discipline and knowledge about the human brain. This is why today we'll discuss things like that, how to become smarter, learn faster, and think in terms of images. In the first half of this episode, we talk broadly about learning in the human brain. We talk about how to become fluent in languages and why the way schools teach languages is usually inefficient, what to do when you're studying and you're feeling confused, how to think in terms of pictures and the way that the brain processes information fastest. And then in the second part of the episode, we talk about the school system and the future skills that Mattias believes in. For example, are we becoming dumbed down? There's a trend to indicate that. Mattias breaks down the science. What does the new school system look like? And which skills will become more valuable or harder to replace in the future? And also, what part of the future makes Mattias excited? Please enjoy this conversation with Mattias. Okay, Mattias, you are a grandmaster of memory. Can you explain what this means?
I have officially reached the standard of grandmaster of memory in a memory competition where you have to memorize over 1,000 random digits in the exact right order. You have 1 hour to memorize them without mistakes. So I did that, and I memorized the correct order of 10 decks of cards in a row, and memorized one deck of card in less than 2 minutes.
And how long would you say from the moment you first started practicing your memory better to when you became a grandmaster of memory?
That was a couple of years, but I took my first title was the Swedish champion, which I achieved after 10 months of training.
That's pretty unusual, right?
Yeah, well, these things go pretty quick. You know, this is a trained ability. I'm not born with any of these kinds of skills. It's just a matter of using your brain in a much more efficient way. And that's what I'm sort of love to do and to explore and to help to educate other people with and so on.
How many other grandmaster of memories are there in the world?
I have no idea right now. Maybe 200 or so, I would guess.
How would you describe this better method of learning?
Well, it's about learning to cooperate with your brain, how it intends to, how it wants you to work. And this is the key, is to think in images. And what happens then in the brain is not just memory, but it increases understanding, focus, energy, the ability to think logically, quicker, and all these things. So it's like in a perfect way to get your brain started to work in the right way.
This is really good because this is a recurring theme on our podcast that we like to talk about transferable skills, skills that you can attain that will, you know, transfer to anything you do in life, yeah. Like using your brain better in new ways and thinking pictorially and so forth. And I'm wondering, you've done a lot of memory coaching, right?
Yeah, well, I've written 4 books. They're in physical books, they're in Swedish, but I do have some online as e-learning courses, my full books. So I've been training people from all walks of life, from CEOs who wants to be better at using their brain more efficiently when it comes to business, to school children, students, and now my latest book is on kids, how to help them to boost their learning. So I've been pretty much all over the place, but this is what I love.
Do you find that there's a specific type of person, maybe a demographic or some, I don't know, maybe they're really interested in personal development or something, or is it a very wide group of people?
Well, who are into the competitions?
No, I mean just the coaching.
No. I mean, everybody, that's the fun thing. And I meet people from all walks of life. It's all kinds of businesses because we're all struggling with the same things. We have to take in new information and we want to do it efficiently, learn new things and so on, and to deal with stress, focus, resilience and all these things. So now it's who doesn't want to use their brain better?
Yeah. Before talking more about memory techniques, you like to emphasize that this isn't about memory. This is about learning and methods to use your brain. Are you tired of people asking you about memory?
No, but I want to... Well, memory, I usually say it like this, that memory is not that important. Memory is a consequence of what has happened before that you can retrace your way back to that. But what happens before, it's so much more. It's when you use your full brain to the perfect, to the best extent, so you can actually, yeah, you can choose to take in information, and then the brain can use it to take better decisions, to gain focus, to increase understanding, and how this affects your analysis of topics and so on. I mean, I never memorize things word by word and so on, because that's what people usually think that I do. I have this thing when I'm, if I give a speech, I have this fun thing that I've always memorized the daily newspaper for people. And I do this also abroad. I was once in Los Angeles at the Bulletproof Biohacking Conference. 1,000 people on the biggest stage. I couldn't really decide which newspaper to memorize, if it should be the Los Angeles Times or the Wall Street Journal. So I memorized them both before the speech. Gave out, handed them to two different people, asked them to just say different pages, and I went on and on about what was being said there. But not word for word. That would have taken years, if that even is possible. But I could recite exactly, with my own words, my own understanding, say what was in that article, and add the odd names, the statistics, the numbers, and so on, but with my own words. So I'm much more than I'm actually, you become an expert. You sound like an expert. You become an expert. You can start to trust your own brain much better. So you also can relax. I mean, this is so much more than just a memory trick.
Kind of implicit in what you're saying is that you have really practiced the ability to have whatever you want top of mind, so that you're able to recall it to the front of your mind when you need it.
Exactly.
And this is very useful no matter what you're doing. Could you give some examples of how you've become good at this, how we can practice this?
Well, the thing is to think in images, and just this top of mind thing is things that you visualize, they also affect your decision making on the spot when you're not really thinking. It goes much deeper, because it then the information, you have created a whole an experience for the brain, so it's a part of your experience, so the brain always refers to it. For one example, when you use this to learn new languages, that instead of just mechanically mention the new word and the translations and so on, like we do, like a robot, what happens with that kind of language learning is that we have to repeat, we have to translate everything in our brain. But if we use images, the new words, for example, if we visualize what a cow look like and we learn the foreign words for it, immediately when we see the image, the new word is being recalled. We don't have to translate in our brain anymore. We learn it directly, and this is learning from these constructed experiences.
I think you could almost draw parallel to going to the gym, where what you're talking about, thinking pictorially, that's much more effective. It's like doing compound exercises instead of doing isolation exercises, which is very slow, going back to the mechanic robotic way of just repeating. It's kind of a similar thing, I think. But what are the 5 different senses that are involved in the learning process or memory formation?
Yeah, well, we do have our different senses, but these are, I would say, generally not that important. Usually memory champions, they say that you have to use all your senses to tactile, to audio, and so on. But the thing is that each sense has separate characteristics. For example, and these are, this, it's more or less the same for everyone. You know, with just auditory phrases, if I would just give you an auditory phrase, in Russian or something that you don't know. To learn it auditory would need so many repetitions. It's not very efficient. That's what we've done in school. We just read the same thing over and over again, thinking that these words will do something. It's inefficient. But so it's about visualization. That is the key. I mean, trying to do these vivid things where you imagine sexual acts and violent things, well, it might be helpful for a deck of cards, but usually in normal life, it's not good. You don't need to do that. It's like you take these kinds of shotgun which fires all over the place and something will hit. If you instead learn how to use your visualization, it's like you have a laser beam, like a laser aim, and just pow, you just do the exact thing that you need and you have full control in your brain. So what you should do is to visualize things in three dimensions. Large in color and detailed. And to learn, teach your brain to become used to visualize. You can visualize regular objects. You don't even need to make stories out of them. You can just see if you visualize a banana that is placed on top of an apple. Just that, the short fragment of an image that pops by, that's enough for the brain if you've done it in three dimensions and so on. It doesn't require, this can be automatized, but making up stories all the time, takes too much effort.
Do you actually see the pictures that you visualize? Because I spent an hour the other day trying to actually see images with my eyes closed, and I don't see anything but some kind of dark static. But what does happen is that I know that if I were to open my eyes and see what I was trying to visualize, then I wouldn't be surprised, because I would know exactly what I was expecting. But I don't actually see them.
No, you don't. Because you don't use your eyes. So this works in a different way. I mean, if I tell you now to visualize a banana, what happens in our brain is that for a fragment of a second, we might think we've seen a small detail, some part of a banana, and then it's gone immediately. It's so fragmented and quick that we don't even know if we've seen it. But the fun thing is that even if it's this and it works like this visualization, even for me, who's trained it so well, it's super vague, but it works.
That's good to hear, because everybody's always talking about pink elephants and that you can't help seeing them.
I wish I could. it's something much more fragmented, but these fragments are enough to simulate this real experience for the brain, so it can guide you. And it becomes, I mean, thinking in images, it's like giving your brain folders, like on a computer, that you can find your way. It's a navigational system. So that's the thing, if I learn the newspaper or read a book and quickly learn it, the thing is that I know where to navigate. I don't encode all of the things. My brain will find it by itself. I just have the navigational system. You know, the normal way of reading that we learn in school, just reading the same thing over and over and hope for the best. That would be like if you on your computer just threw in documents in the computer without names or locations. Sure, they would be on the hard drive, but you would never be able to find the right thing when you need it. But instead, when you think visually, it's like you gave it, you know where to look in your brain. So it's easily, it's direct learning. You don't have to mumble through a long song or anything like that. The brain can find those visual images so quick.
Have you ever thought how this might coincide or have to do with the Carl Jung idea about archetypes and mental schemas?
Oh, yes. That's a whole big topic, but super interesting. And myths, how we bring them and what those mental images shapes us as humanity, as a human being. Everything that is transferred through child stories, everything, it's all about inner images. I mean, there is no, if you say that we can't see an image, just ask a child, can a child play? What do children do when they play? They see things that are not there. They don't see a stick when you're in the forest. They see also a pirate sword lying around there. They're expert. Everyone can do it.
I just finished two long Chinese sci-fi books by a writer called Lu Xixin. And that's actually the only name I remember from both books. So this is like 1,000 pages of sci-fi with at least 10 main characters. And I cannot recall one single name. Do you think about this? Do you have any trouble remembering the names of characters in books?
No, absolutely not. And especially like Lu Shixin and things like that. I'm trained to go for the most difficult things. And those I make sure to remember. I mean, these things will stick for everyone. But when you have the trained skill, you can go for the difficult things immediately. But it's interesting that the brain tries to do this by itself. Because if you read this book, and then, you know, if you read a sci-fi book, and then if you see that as a movie, then you are always disappointed. Because they didn't match up with what you have already seen. Because if we read a novel, then we will have seen fragments of some of the persons in the book, some places and events. And those fragments, I mean, these visualized fragments, they become like the magnets that draw the whole story to them, like the connection points in the brain. So thanks to these small fragments, that's how we navigate through a story. So we can follow along a 1,000-page book story, no problem. And when we think about what might happen in the future of the book, we navigate further on using these fragments of images. So our brain is so good at this. And that's why they say, you know, that a good author invokes vivid images in you, and that, because that's how it is. But now, learning to do this consciously, we don't even need a good author. We can do it for the most dry material of for anything, just plain boring statistics. We can make it come alive so the brain can easily navigate through that as well.
So you've been able to practice and develop these cognitive markers, or however you want to call it, and like place them. And then by doing that, like putting down a pole, then and you place several poles, and that creates a mental context that just provides a narrative for everything has to fit into.
Yeah. And if you visualize at the same time that you read, so really do it simultaneously, like it's like you have this a small vacuum cleaner, your brain, it just vacuums up what's being said there, because it's being attached to this experience of the pole that you put in. So everything gathers around the pole, and thanks through the pole, you can see the pole for miles away. Oh, that's it. And then you will find your way to the information in the brain.
So if I'm correct, one of the most famous memory techniques is called a memory palace. Is this something you practice?
Sure. I mean, that's when you use locations where you place certain things. But the actual mechanism in the brain is that you use something that you already know to connect something new with that.
It's association.
Yes. And more, you can do it intentionally, or it happens automatically many times also. But you can use other things, you know. So not only locations, you can use familiar objects. I've popularized this exercise called the Ribbing's bike, where you place things along a bike, and you can play. So you don't even need to go out to a palace. You can use so many things that you already know of how things look, and we can separate hundreds and thousands of objects easily in our brain without mixing up what a ladder looks like and what the inner image of a car tire, for example. No way we would match them up. We can even separate. I bet you could separate between 10 different shampoo bottles of different brands without even being a shampoo expert. When you know your way in the grocery store to find the right one, you can navigate that. So we all have this, all our senses are tied to something three-dimensional. So when they talk about a smell, you know, smells being strong creates memories and taste and so on. Yes, they do, but they're always tied to something three-dimensional. The smell is tied to a person, a place, or a food dish, or something like that.
Maybe we should tell the listener to visualize you, and not just that you're very big for this room, dressed in black and in 3D, but also that you close your eyes for almost half the time you're speaking. So I'm guessing that you are visualizing a lot of things when you answer the questions.
Yeah, that's more. Actually, I visualize with my eyes open, but now I just relax when I talk, not looking at you, really to find the right answers at the right time, being in focus, relaxed, and having a good time, basically. So yeah. I like closing my eyes also.
Personally, I don't know if I'm super good at visualization and so forth, but it's something that I'm practicing and I want to become really, really good at it over the next maybe 5 years. But what I've had great success with so far is different kinds of association techniques, using book summary books and like synthesizing information that you've read, for example, like a repetition. And also using a commonplace system, which goes back to what you're saying about creating the folders. And that is the most important thing in creating a commonplace system for me. Because of that, I can basically go around and have a lot of ideas, and then I can file the ideas in my different folders very easily. Then I have a system for this, which makes it very easy for me to like have a ton of ideas, which I then place in the right way. And it's not the same thing as visualization, but it's... I don't know. Have you experimented with this, like commonplacing?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the word, but what I did something similar. The good thing about having these skills is when I research for writing books, for example, I drive a lot in the car, have a lot of travels to do. And normal people, so to speak, they can't research intensely while driving because you need to check up different things. But what I can do, I can listen to audiobooks in double speed. And then only for the parts that I'm really need for my book project, for example, that I need to listen through. And immediately when something interesting comes up, I can visualize what it is and where it is on the numbers, for example, on the time, the minute, the date, the timestamp, and so on. And then I can go in the normal book later. So I might have after 40 of these after going on a car trip. And then afterwards, I can quickly check the references, check out the research, check out how you spell these names and so on very easily. So that's just something similar, maybe.
That's extremely useful. I think we're talking about kind of the same thing, but in my sort of methodology, I would call that accessing the subconscious somehow. I don't know. That's just how I would like think about it. Hmm. But
I do all this with control. I mean, it's like using this. It's like you always have a notepad, a physical notepad in front of you, your face that no one else sees. And I can always scribble something in there if I hear something interesting. And I can come up with, but no one sees that I'm using this, but I always have it there.
Do you have any kind of physical system or system outside the brain to keep track and organize your information? So that was what Ludwig was getting at with a commonplace system. So like a structured notebook for very long-term information organization.
No, that's just folders in my computer. That would be then. But it's interesting because I'm... actually start this because of laziness. I didn't, I was always the unstructured, lazy person. Oh, I don't want to take notes. I just, it would be better to just sit there and take it in immediately. So that was sort of, I always have my laziness as my prime motivator, I would say. So I don't overdo things. I try to do just the most efficient thing that I need and to skip the rest.
I like to study like super successful people from different fields. And one thing that comes up a lot is that people who are at sort of a genius level in a specific field often have an ability to think like a movie or pictorially specifically to that field, but they can't always transfer it to other things. One example is the rapper Currency. He's a rapper I like to listen to, and he always says that like he's really prolific. He can write many songs every day, and the reason he does that is because he sees it like a movie and then he just tells it. And he's not that good at rhyming or anything. He just basically tells a story, but he can do it very easily and very prolifically because he sees it in his head. Another example is John von Neumann, the mathematician polymath. He could see like almost any kind of number in his head, like a scale. And this was told by Feynman. But that's another example. And then a third example is Ray Dalio, who is one of the biggest financial thinkers. He's not very good with words. He's really bad at explaining things, but he's super smart and he can visualize extremely well. And he can visualize the economy like a machine, and he can see interest rates influencing the whole system and so forth. And that's a really cool ability that I would like to have.
Yeah, and I think we all do. I mean, if you've ever experienced, for example, if you had this one great teacher where you were when you were in school who opened up a whole subject for you, which you started to love, and you were full of interest, and he opened up the world for you. You could see it in front of you. So that's these keys. You can unlock these in all areas. Now that you know that's how you do it, you visualize it. And then there are some other keys, like, for example, that you always should start with simple summaries, for example, to get into an area and so on. So you do it in a right and good order. But then there's no stop. You could basically do the same for anything if you know that that's the key.
Could you tell us about your concept, the Teflon brain?
Yeah, that's it. I think we all had this feeling when we just sit and listen to something and nothing sticks. The day after, or a few hours after, everything is gone. It's like you were not there. You hear the words, but it's like water pouring off a frying pan. It's very annoying. But there is a reason for this, and it's not about tiredness. No, it's the reason for having this Teflon brain syndrome is that what you're listening to or reading is too new. It's too new, so it doesn't connect to something that you know. And all learning is that we connect something new to something we already know. And I mean, this was the reason that I was lousy with history in school, and I could not understand why. I tried to listen, I tried to pay attention, it worked hard. Other things worked, but just history didn't work. And the key was there, that I didn't know it then, but I had basically no idea. I had no overview. I lacked key concepts, so everything was just new all the time. So nothing could stick. No connections were created.
Yeah, one of my favorite tricks specifically for history is to learn a couple of the greatest men for each era. Because then, going back to the mental markers, then you can create a context around that and it becomes easier to place the information.
Exactly. That's it.
And when I was little, my dad always told me to look up every word you can't explain to somebody else. And I thought that was quite a handful to do. There were too many words to look up. But once I started doing that, then I realized that I would never get to the end of a page without remembering or understanding what was said. So that really became my superpower at school, to understand every word.
That's a really good one right there.
And going back to the Teflon brain, just to reiterate, you're advising that when you come over new information and it confuses you and it bewilders you, you should stop.
Yeah.
And then when you stop, you should feel the confusion and try to let the brain try to connect it.
No, that really doesn't help. But the thing is that I always do this with school kids, that when you don't understand, stop doing it. Don't read the same thing over and over and hope for something magic to happen, because it won't. I mean, doing the exact thing over and over, we need to do that if we learn to play the piano or something with motor skills. But if you want to understand something new, we need many perspectives. We need new. You have to stop doing that and go to find short summaries. So you should always start by reading several short summaries of different origins. What happens then is that you actually learn more deep. That's the thing, because if you read many short summaries, you can more easily than afterwards connect the information to different areas, different subjects. Then if you just start to read one thick book with tons of reference, and that's much more shallow for you if you start there. You will only know how to repeat that deep thing. So that's why actually, for example, journalists, they become experts. They learn deep quickly because they can connect the things on a much better level quicker.
That's also a way of extracting the underlying reality from a lot of imperfect signals.
Yeah.
And it's a technique that I use for browsing books or movies. So I read reviews from several different sources.
Mm.
So maybe not as serious as what you're talking about, but I think that maybe that is something that younger people could relate to, because when they want to find a good game or book,
yeah, that's
or
what
movie,
that's
what they do. So they could do that in school as well.
Exactly. See, the same way. The problem is that you should, many times Wikipedia will confuse you. That's usually not the best place to start, because that's not short summaries. That can be super detailed. If you want to look up something with has to do with math and you go to Wikipedia, I mean, that will kill you right there, because it's too detailed. So try to find other things, short video summaries and so on. So if you use this strategy, and when you read, you visualize simultaneously, try to see in front of you what is happening. Then there you have a really strong cocktail of techniques together. You can add a third one also, which I call position reading. It's that you read one chapter or one paragraph, depending on how detailed it is, per position. So you start, you read the first part when you're at your desk. Then you go immediately, you go sit on the toilet lid and read the next part. And you go to the kitchen, read the third part. And you do this for all that you have to learn. And what happens then is that the brain connects where you are, what the outer things that happens, and your inner thoughts, what you're learning. It connects together. So the brain also creates this, it becomes the folders of the brain once again. So you start to own the information. You can find your way back to it. It's marvelous to do this. It's so easy.
As a kind of an analogy to this, you're an outspoken user of the Pomodoro technique, and I'm wondering, do you think it would be a good idea to apply the same technique with the Pomodoro? So let's say you're working on your laptop, and then you do position working, and you change position every 25 minutes.
It depends. If you're dealing with learning, it's good. If it's just going through invoices, it doesn't matter. Then it doesn't help you. Well, short breaks are always good, but this should be when you want to learn new things.
Let's do a final question about memory and learning, which is how can people learn a new language much faster than what they probably usually do?
Okay. Three things when language learning. One, use only fun material. Forget all the boring language books we got in school and so on. Language is about communication. That's the main thing. It doesn't matter what you communicate, but you start communicate. So, I mean, a language teacher should focus on having fun. You can just chill out and talk about various things. But if you do it in the new language, you can watch now you can get your favorite TV series in all kinds of languages very easily on streaming sites and so on. So do that. I mean, my kids, they're 4 and 7, they're fluent in English. That's because we never showed them Swedish television child programs, actually. We said we'll do it in English immediately, so they will they're bilingual immediately. So that's super easy in a way. So fun things. Second thing, now when you're bigger, is learn many new words. I mean, that's you can't get around that. But you should use a word frequency dictionary. They are online for free. You can find them in all languages, word frequency lists or dictionaries. So where you start with the most common words. Because if you start doing that, I mean, in beginning, it's very, very short fragments of words, but you can test yourself so you can create one sentence with each word, and then you can pass to the next and to the next. And if you learn in that way, you won't have to repeat, to use repetitions. You won't have to, because these common words will repeat themselves, because you will hear them all the time, because they're common. That's the stupid thing in school when we were taught these strange words were thrown into the most first chapters. Even if we study these words, we will never hear them again for a year or several. So even if we knew it, we will have forgotten about it when we need it the next time. And so I noticed this. I mean, I studied German in school and I did a lot of it. I could tell my later German friends all kinds of grammatical rules they had no idea existed. But I couldn't basically talk with the German. It's so ridiculous. So that's, and a lot thing was that I had several of the early words that were still missing. So if you just do this 1 hour exercise, that you go through a word frequency dictionary, you single out the 30 most common words that you don't know, and you learn them. I mean, then you will have a whole new step in your language learning just after 1 hour.
There is a very good site called 1000mostcommonwords.com. And there are, I think, around 50 languages, and the list of the 1,000 most common words there. So we'll include that in the newsletter.
Yeah. And there is this study about that they've done on Spanish language learning, that they saw that if you knew the 1,000 most common Spanish words, you understand 87% of regular talking.
Let's shift the discussion to the school system and intelligence. So to begin with, do you believe that in the last couple of decades, we're becoming dumbed down?
Unfortunately, there there is, I usually don't like this, you know, the even Socrates said that the youth of today, they are just going downhills. I mean, every generation says that because out of the bias. But unfortunately, there is some serious science that is backing this up now, this claim. One area is in intelligence tests. There's always been this thing called the Flynn effect, where they've seen clearly that each generation become more intelligent than the last. And this is such a rapid increase in intelligence that it's been decade after decade throughout the 20th century, 3 intelligence points per 10 years. It's incredible. But that has now stopped and started to decline. And scientists don't agree on why this Flynn effect does exists for the first place, and they're not sure why it has now started to decrease. But since 1995 was the year that the gains turned into losses. This is from the very latest reviews of these mass intelligence studies. But that's just one thing. There's also the Torrance tests of creativity, mass testing of problem solving and innovation and so on that they've done from the 1950s. This set of 18 or so tests that they test every 10 years. And then they saw that we became more and more creative and able to solve problems each 10 years up to the decade of the 1990s. And even that has started to decline. So this is worrisome stuff.
So what's happening?
Well, the scientists argue that perhaps it has to do with electronic culture being more widespread, and that they frame it as we shift from abstract thinking to more concrete thinking. In my terminology, I call that we are served ready-made experiences from TV and everything. You know, when we use our imagination and we visualize, we create our experiences. And this is what makes you more intelligent. That's just how it is.
There's a great, a lot of good material from the educator Mortimer Adler on a similar topic. And he was definitely of the same opinion, which is that ever since TV started showing up, you were just trying to package information into the simplest possible image so that you don't have to think. You should just be able to consume it.
Yeah.
That doesn't challenge your thinking and it reduces your vocabulary.
Exactly. That's it. Speaking of vocabulary, that's interesting. They've done tests since I've now written a book on parenting and learning and so on. There have been studies where they used iPads for learning new words and for children. And what they saw that the children learn much less words when they use learning programs for learning words on iPads. The best way to learn it is to just communicate, talk in normal life. That's how children learn rapidly.
I remember how angry I got back in school, in middle school, when the teacher suggested such things, because she said, you need to speak to learn. And I was thinking, well, I was slightly autistic, so I was thinking, but how can I speak if I don't know the words? But I get what you're saying, and I completely agree now. But back then, I definitely didn't.
That's it. Also, even in kindergarten, they've seen that children develop their vocabularies best when even not adults are in the games with them. When they are the small children who don't no one really knows anything, when they're on their own exploring, that's when they learn the most. It's so fascinating.
What are your suggestions for school today to perhaps remedy some of these issues?
Yes, get the inner playing going. That's it. Using your imagination, your fantasy. I mean, that's what I did when I became a grandmaster of memory. Something that looks boring, like memorizing 1,000 random digits. I mean, for me, that was all imagination, seeing things. And you can do that when studying. So what we can help our children and ourselves in really make it an inner game, make it fun, make it a play. Children always learn so much when they're out playing before they start school, basically. So we can help the children and help ourselves by getting the inner play into the schoolwork. That's when it comes alive, like this teacher I told who just opened something up.
Could you articulate what you think or a couple of problems with the existing school system.
Yes.
Having worked as an educator and so forth.
Well, I mean, there are great teachers out there. They're really fantastic teachers, so nothing wrong with them. The Swedish school system, they have has a lot of problems. That's just how it is. And the teachers try to deal with this the best way they can. So all my respect to teachers out there who do a great job. And but then they many times they are so limited, at least in Sweden. They are more and more strictly micromanaged in how and when exactly what they have to do, and then they can't use their skill as a teacher to translate in their way, their own vision. And then you get this mechanical robot situation where everyone should learn the same thing at the same time. And so on. So all this going into more testing from earlier and earlier age. I mean, there is even disadvantages of starting to learn certain things too early.
How early is too early?
Well, for example, when you see these videos of like 2-3 year olds learning math, for example, that might destroy math for them. We have the dogs here. So that the reason is that what small children do, they only repeat. They cannot think mathematically. So then they learn that mathematics has something to do with just repeating. So they're not mature to get into real mathematical thinking. So leave it alone. Let them play. Let them develop their imagination. That will be much more useful for them in real learning later.
And kids are still sitting in class most of the time. Should they still be sitting?
Well, no, not really. And that's because they have to be governed in some way. So now there's a lot of problems for sure. Not easy to solve. But what we can do as parents, don't increase these pressures. The pressure turns up. We spend more time in school than ever before. Don't push this further when they get home and when you go then to the next and the next, always the new activities that are always driven by adults, where we're just simply told to obey orders, whether it's in the hockey rink or in the dancing class or whatever. So free time is so important for children's brains, also for our brains, but especially for children who don't have readily developed brains. They need much, 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 much more real free time than our adults, where they have to think about what they should do for themselves, to activate themselves.
In developing the future school system, do you think we should have more of a marginal point of view or a radical point of view? And what I mean is, should we improve upon the existing system, or should we do away with it and create something new?
Well, this is such a Swedish way of framing your question, because you're asking, what way should everyone do to fix this? That is the problem from the beginning. We don't need one version. We need to let 1,000 flowers bloom, as to quote a communist, Mao Zedong.
Okay, I was just going to ask what you had before you came here.
No, but well, I'm advocating the opposite, that we don't need one regulation. And that's the problem with Sweden, that everyone should do it in the same way. If we let people do it in very many different ways, we can see what works, and we can see what doesn't work, and we can learn from each other, and then we can have real progress. Not just for example, in Finland, the politicians agreed that let's not make school a political issue, but we leave that outside and let the pedagogues and the professors, researchers handle that, and we argue other things in politics. That is one thing to do also. But yeah, we're stepping into a new kind of world. We are in a new kind of world information-wise, and the school system is so old. It's developed for factory workers, children, and so on. We have something new, so nobody knows what the best thing is. We just have to let people try different things and see.
I actually know what the best thing is.
Oh, great.
And it's that everybody listening should One, listen to your TED Talk and then implement those ideas.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. I could stretch myself. We can make that a mandatory thing. Yeah.
And how can one find it? We will include the link, but even audio.
Yes. You can go to my webpage, grandmasterofmemory.com, or just Google my name, Mattias Ribbing. You'll find it.
Great. So then everybody watches that and reads up on your page and then just transfer that knowledge onto their children.
Yes.
I think what you're saying about the school system, about the Finland example, is a really good, I think that's really good, and I agree with it in principle. And I think it's kind of what's happening with the internet. I think the new education system will, I have no idea how it will happen, but I think it will naturally take place through the internet somehow. I don't know how, if it will be like companies or state-wise or some merger, but it's going to happen through the internet, I believe. And by having people learn more on their own and then having that immersed in culture. We don't have that yet. It's probably going to take another 20 years or something until it becomes embedded in our culture worldwide. But I think it's starting.
Yeah, the thing what we had before, we had diplomas and marks, grades on a paper that gave us a job. It's not like that anymore. I mean, even now, it's like what employers are interested in is actual proof of work, to have to show something, to do something, to be someone. So it's shifting already.
Yeah, when I hired analysts to my hedge fund, I didn't pay that much attention to what schools they went to or what grades they got. I actually was more interested in the fluency in their letters, in their cover letters.
Yeah. I've also worked in sales and hired people, and grades were totally uninteresting.
You being a parent, pedagogue, and also a grandmaster of memory. What do you think are some easy fixes that can still have a big impact to implement to the existing school system?
Because there's no easy fixes to the system, that's for sure. That doesn't exist. But our day-to-day living, we can learn efficient ways of dealing with the situations. So that is to work on what is the most important thing, is that is our relations to our children and to each other, to learn to cooperate. I mean, if you have a family, to learn to cooperate in the house, to work on difficult issues, to solve problems, not just argue, but strive for real improvement in your relationships, because that helps everything. Schools, works, your lowers stress, everything. So if there's one thing you should work on, is this. And I mean, that's usually the toughest parts that we want to avoid, the thing that annoys us, the things that if we focus on these, many of the outer things will basically solve themselves and become fun again, because it's not this, your home base becomes something of a things where you can recharge, so you can deal with this crappy school or whatever that you're into. So we won't be served the perfect school or the perfect system. That will never happen. So it's much better to, we still need to learn to deal with difficult things. And then you have to go into the basics, also into yourself, and to listen to yourself, not just be run like crazy in the rat race. I mean, you have to stop, question yourself, what you're doing. So what is the important things in your life? To make space for this, to make room, and then the difficult things will be more easy to handle.
It's a great answer. I think inherent in it is basically take more responsibility and reflect more. What do you think are some skills that will become harder to replace by machines in the future?
Well, it's human cooperation, vision, innovation. I mean, we, with our visualization, our visions, we set the, what kind of future do we want to have? I mean, it's not like we have one fixed future that the robots will do the best of calculating. I mean, we can have it in many different ways, and it's up to us to work in that direction with what do we want to have. That's not possible to automatize. So, but I mean, now the thing is that problem solving is the key. Now, back in the days of industrialization and before that, jobs were things you did exactly what you were told. Problem solving was something that occurred if a mistake happened. Now we're hired on the basis of problem solving, because no one else, that's your job. So this, to increase that, we have to learn, our children have to learn to solve problems. and we can't do it for them, then they won't learn it. So this ties in a lot with all these things that we've talked about. So hopefully that will give a little bit of a whole picture, so that we can't fix things for our children or for society. We can start to do something ourselves, then just deal with whatever comes up.
That's a great answer. Let's do one final question. What excites you most about the future?
That it's not known. I love the unknown. I welcome the unknown, and I have no idea about anything, and I'm quite happy with that. That's what makes me tick.
And that also means it will be more easy to remember it when it happens, since it will be new.
Yes, yes, it will.
All right, Matthias, where can people reach you?
Grandmasterofmemory.com. That's it. You can contact me there.
And to watch your TED Talk.
Yes, please.
Great conversation, Matthias. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week. Do subscribe to our newsletter over at www.futureskillspodcast.com, and you will get weekly summaries and a free ebook. As always, you can find the link to our newsletter in the bottom of the episode descriptions. And finally, a thank you to Alexander Martin, who does all of our sound editing. Thanks, and see you next week.